My name is John Michael. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
Good to see everybody here. All you shining faces. Good to be anywhere, I guess, on a Saturday night. And I'm actually on time. Dan sent me a text before coming out here. He said, we'll see you tonight. A few minutes late, I'm sure. And that prompted me to get here on time, right? My home group is the Frisco group right down the road, but I attend a lot of different meetings in the area. As a kid, I always wanted to be like John Wayne. Now, being like John Wayne is difficult when people look at you and say, you look like Howdy Doody all the time. Or Ralph Mouth, Danny Partridge, I got all of them, right? So here I am wanting to be like John Wayne. There was a guy in our group, in fact, at the Frisco group. His name was, I hadn't seen him in a while. His name is Bruno. And I always used to think, man, it would be great to be Bruno. But when you're walking around at my size, looking like Danny Partridge, it is tough. You guys have brought me a long way. My sobriety date, literally, oh, so much by the grace of God, is May 29th of 1989. So I just celebrated in May 30 years of continuous sobriety, right? And what you're clapping for is yourself there, right? It's interesting. I will have people that come up to me, especially that are outside the program, and they'll say, John Michael, that is fantastic. You have been sober for 30 years. You should be so proud of yourself. And I don't know if you're the same way, but when I hear people say that to me, especially outside of the program, I think to myself, well, I don't know. If somebody comes up to me at work and they says, you know, you made a great presentation, or, you know, that sales process that you did was absolutely fantastic, or you did a good job and whatever sort of project it is you were involved in, I think, well, thank you very much. But somebody comes up to me and says, you ought to be proud of yourself for being sober. It takes me aback a little bit, right? I don't feel like it is, yes, I've had my part, right? I come and I do things, you know, like Dan says, you know, I'm involved in several different arenas of AA and I love, and it doesn't feel like work, you know, I mean, it's not like work to come here. It's not like work when I go to meetings, you know, to me, it is something that, that you guys have helped me with. And that you made that come true in my life. You know, they say each of us are like angels with only one wing. And the only way that we can fly is to embrace each other. Well, you guys have been my other wing for many years now. And I couldn't have done it without you. There's an old story about a little girl who goes on vacation to Europe. And while she's over there in Europe, she visits all the various cathedrals that she has, that she sees and people take her to. While she's in the cathedral, she looks out the stained glass windows, and all of these stained glass windows have these beautiful angels in them. And when she gets back to the United States, people ask her what she did while she was on vacation, and she says, well, while I was on vacation, I saw the angels. And they said, who are the angels? Who are you talking about? And she said, the angels are the people that let the light in. And you guys have been the people that let the light in for me. Cuervo was my thing. I loved Cuervo tequila. And I realize now they always say, well, it's not the best tequila. Well, I don't, it was the best to me at that time when I was drinking. And I loved to get my hand on Cuervo. It just absolutely, I can still feel it. Like I would take a couple of pulls on that Cuervo bottle. And, by the way, sometimes it was the bottle, sometimes it was shot glasses. It didn't really matter. I was looking for the effect. Speaking of the effect, before I go into that, I was getting some coffee one day at the office where I was working. This was probably around 1995 or so. And I'll never forget. I was on my way out to come to a noon meeting and I was getting some coffee. And, the girl Allison came up to me and she said, wow. She goes, you drink a lot of coffee. She goes, do you like to drink caffeinated or decaf? And I said, I drink coffee essentially because I like the effect produced by caffeine. And she was like, what does that mean? I said, you wouldn't quite understand, you know? And that's why I drank alcohol. I drank alcohol essentially because I like the effect produced by alcohol. And anyway, I would take a couple of pulls off of that tequila bottle. It would go down my trachea, and I can still feel, like, when it would come down, and I can still feel this today, right? When it would come down, and it would go down my windpipe, and it would come into my stomach, and I could feel that warmth coming through my body. And then my fingers would start to tingle a little bit, and I would get this just kind of calm and peaceful feel. In fact, I'm getting a little excited right now thinking about it, so I'm gonna slow down a little bit there. But I would get this calm and peaceful effect that came over me, and not all my friends got that. Right? There was a buddy of mine who I was just talking to. I just went to a high school reunion, and he knew me back in the day. And I told him, you know, what I had been up to in terms of my recovery. And he said, you know, I can see that. And he also pointed out a couple of other my buddies. He goes, yeah, they had a problem too, you know. And we were all hanging together. The difference between me and him is he had what I called a governor. He was getting loaded just like the rest of us. But, you know, when it came time to, like, hey, somebody showed up with a little bit of chocolate mescaline. If you know what that is or not. But when they showed up with that stuff, I was going, let's turn it on. And he's like, no, I've had enough. Let's kind of pull back here, right? He had that governor within him, and I never had that governor. Like all of you, I was, this is an open meeting, maybe not like all of you, but for those of you who are alcoholic, I was there and I was taking it until it was gone. And I heard people say, I never had any fun when I was drinking. I'm like, hey, man, next time you go back out, you come get me. I will show you how to have fun. Because I had I don't know if I'd go for that thing about I wouldn't trade my best day drunk for my worst day sober, whatever the case may be. I get the sentiment, right? I don't want to go back to drinking, but I had some damn good times while I was drinking. My favorite drinking song was always Desperado by the Eagles. I love that song. And I would, I had this little Honda CRX that I drove. It was my first, my brand new car, which, by the way, I bought with stolen money. In fact, people would come in here, they'd say, you know, well, at least I have cash register, honestly. I took all of that money directly out of a cash register and bought my first new car. So I was like going, well, I really have some work to do here. In fact, you know, they hooked me up to those same people suspected that I may be taking money out of a cash register. You know, you can get away with stuff like that when you look like Ralph Mouth, by the way. It makes it much easier, the advantages, you know. But anyway, so I was stealing all this money, and they took me downtown, and they said, we want you to do a lie detector test. And I said, and they took me down, and you know what? I passed that thing with flying colors. Sad, huh? Right? I mean, at one point, somebody else told in that meeting in AA once, and they kind of go, well, that's kind of good news, bad news, right? Good news that you can pass the test like that. The bad news is that I could fool myself even. And so that's the kind of attitude I was coming in here with. And so anyway, my favorite drinking song was Desperado. I would drive this little Honda CRX down the road. I would drink as much of that tequila as I possibly could, and then I would turn up that Desperado song. And when it got to that crescendo, this was the one that always killed me. It was like, because I was living the life of a desperado, basically. I said, "You better let somebody love you before it's too late." And I would hear that, and I would just start bawling my eyes out. So I'm driving down the highway, crying, drunk as can be, listening to this song. And the Department of Public Safety does not recommend that as a way of getting down the highway. But I just want to mention that, just in case you were curious about all that. I have so many drunk stories. You know, here's the deal. I had about a 12 years of good drinking, and a lot of that involved what do you call them now, accessories, something like that. There's a lot of things going on. And I'm convinced for me and a lot of people in my generation, that really amped things up to get me in here sooner. Because when you are participating in all those various accessories, the only thing that can bring you down the only thing that could bring me down was that alcohol, and it would kind of take the edge off. And in fact, I could drink some. You could hardly even feel the alcohol at that point. So that really built up my tolerance. I was going through that for years and years and years. And so coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was like coming from one room where I knew everything about how to live that way of life. I was a thief. I've already told you that. I was a vandal. Oh man, I was a very good vandalizer, if there is such a thing. I mean, I used to tell people that I was not an angry guy. You know why I would tell them that? Because here's the thing. I would hang out with guys like Dan or something like that, right? And I would go into a situation and I would flip over a table, yell at somebody, start something, and then I'm back out of there, right? And guys like Dan and all these other, I had like all these alpha males that I hung around. Most of them were like 6'4" and stuff like that. And they would kind of clean up the mess. But for me, I thought, I'm never in fist fights. But I would go out and I would be breaking mirrors left and right on cars. This is before they collapsed, you know. Now they collapse. It'd be no fun if you're a vandal. I would steal things off walls. I would walk through offices all the time. And like I'd see that TV or that coffee machine or whatever the case may be. And I ask my wife sometime when we're driving down the road, I'll look over in somebody's yard and I go, do you ever like think about getting that and putting it in like our trunk or anything like that? And she's like, no, I don't think. Me neither. I'm wondering if you think that. I would never do something like that. So, but the idea, I still think about that stuff all the time. So I was a thief and I was a vandal. I was basically taking anything that wasn't tied down. Figure if they didn't tie it down, they didn't really, really want it. And then I would go over to my friend's house. Once again, I'm looking like Ralph Mouth, right? And their friends would all, they call me Johnny back in high school. All their friends would say, why can't you act like Johnny? He's so polite. I was like Leave It to Beaver, Eddie Haskell, right? So, you know, so I look great in front of the parents. But I was living this really like double life. But the end of my drinking, the last 4 to 5 years, was pretty much problems, pretty much lonely. And I didn't have anything that I was. By that time, the fun, it was over. This had become a lifestyle. It was a sad lifestyle. It was mainly me holing up in my apartment by myself, drinking, and putting my and just passing out every night. And there was always the yes, but I got to the point to where, you know, I mean, I was working this one particular job to where I had to open a safe in the morning, believe it or not. Anyway, and I would have to go in there and, you know, I could not open that safe. I would have to sit. If anybody was around, I was not opening that safe because I wasn't going to let them see me do that, right? So I was having to open that safe and my hands were shaking beyond control. I would sit sometimes at night and I would say to myself, okay, this is the night. I'm not going to go out and drink. This is the one night. And then about 11 o'clock or so, I would just start shaking violently, and I'd say, I've got to go. And I would run out to the bar, and I would drink as much between 11:30 and 12 in this particular area that all shut down at 12 as they would let me drink. I tried to set up systems for myself, but it just did not work. So my experience, and by the way, I was atheist, I was agnostic. My experience in coming to believe that there's a power greater than myself was sitting in rooms just like that and thinking to myself, well, it can happen for Barry. If it can happen for Barry, it can happen for me. So that was my experience in coming to believe in a power greater than myself. And I heard somebody say this once about belief. They said, I have a tendency to look at it this way in my relationship with God. I have a tendency to go to God and say, you show me and then I will believe. And God reverses it. He says, you believe, and then I'll show you. I got to the third step, and I did that with my sponsor. We went into the little Al-Anon room like we did over at the Carrollton group. It was much like that. You know, we'd have the AA room out there, and then the Al-Anons would all meet in some separate room, and we'd go over there. We did all kinds of fifth steps and third steps and all kinds of step work in there in those rooms. And he said, I want you to think about this before we take this third step. I don't want you taking this third step unless you are committed to the other steps. He says, this is not like walking down the aisle at church, which I had done a few times, right? And then you come back and you don't live any sort of different life. It's just the same thing. What we want you to do is we want you to take this third step, and you're going to be committed to the fourth step after that. Can you do that? And by this time, I had been in and out of the rooms from 86 to 89, 3 years. And I had a well-whooped ass, as they say. And so I said, yes, sir, I will do that. And his name's Bob L., and Bob L. is still my sponsor today. He still goes to the Carrollton group. So now it's been 30-plus years. I tell him that he's a temporary sponsor. I'm going to try him out for a while, kind of see how this goes, and then I'm going to make him permanent. I'm thinking about promoting him pretty soon, but I don't want to give him a big head. So anyway, we went to that room and we did the third step prayer, and we got down on our knees, right, which a lot of people do, very strange experience, and I read that third step, and it said, still says, page 63, just in case you haven't heard of it before, I hope all of you have. It says, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Says, here I am, God. You could take my health problems. You could take my job issues. You could take these relationships that I have around Thanksgiving and Christmas with all my family members and extended family members and all my friends. I'm giving all of these to you. I'm giving all this to you. And then it says, relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Because if I'm always looking at me, if I'm constantly looking at me and what I am doing in this world and how it affects me and how it revolves around me, and I'm not thinking about how I can impact people in my community and how I can add to their lives. The book says how I can add to the stream of life. If I'm not doing those things and I'm constantly thinking about me, there's no way that I can be helping you. And it drags me down into a pit. And then the last line of it says, take away my difficulties. Take away my difficulties, Father, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help with thy power and thy love and thy way of life. It doesn't say take away my difficulties that I may get rich, that I may have fame, that I may have glory. It says take away my difficulties that I can be an example. Take away my difficulties that other people can look at me and say, you worked in that individual's life. And now that person is different because of how you entered into his life. May I do thy will always. And so we did that, and then we got started right into the fourth and the fifth step. And I did not think that I was going to have anything to put on my fourth step where resentments were concerned. Once again, I'm not an angry guy. All these other things. And then I would hear people talk in the meetings. I'm like, they're always talking about resentments. These are angry people. I mean, my goodness, what is going on with these folks? I had 183 resentments when I finally got into my fourth step. It took me a little while, but I got going. And all of a sudden, it just all came pouring out. And I went to this counselor. I said, do you think I'm depressed? He goes, from a 1 to 10, you're 9.5 depressed. And a lot of that's because of anger. And so it just came pouring out, right? And then we did the fears, and then we did the sex inventory and all that. Then I got to 6 and 7, and basically the whole idea for 6 and 7 with me was like, okay, there's a line in the 12 and 12 that says, it's quoting another book that a lot of us read. It says, be ye perfect. And so I read that in there, and I thought, what the hell are they saying, be ye perfect? I mean, obviously I can't be perfect. And I don't think what they're saying in there in either book is that I have to be perfect. But the idea is that I have, when I get up in the morning and when I say, hey, Pops, it's time to get going. The idea is that I'm to say, okay, I have another shot at life today. I'm up. I'm at 'em. Here I am. Let's go. For me, I'm supposed to aim to be perfect. Now, here's the challenge, is that I aim that arrow at being perfect, but I always fall short. I always go off to the left. I always go off to the right. Sometimes it just comes right out the bow thing, whatever that's called, and goes right into the ground. But the idea for me is that I'm to aim for that. And everybody is at a different point on that path. And by that I mean, it's like I've been given the directive to jump to the moon. All of us is how I see it. Now, some of us make it 6 feet, and some of us make it 6 inches, but we also have a very, very long way to go. I was raised by a single mom. Her name was Sheila. She came from Scotland. She probably had an eighth grade education. My dad met her when he was in the U.S. Air Force and he was over in Scotland. She grew up in an area town called, or an area of Scotland called Glasgow. Anyone I've ever talked to from that area will go, ooh, Glasgow, it's kind of a tough area. So she grew up in a tough area. So they had me. And they were together and I was an Air Force brat for the first 6 years of my life. Just in case you don't know what that is, it just means we moved around quite a bit, several different places. When I was about 5 or 6, they decided to divorce. I don't remember much about it, but all I knew is I was with my mom. We were living in Wichita Falls, Texas. She was raising me from that point. So, and the background there is important because around 13 or 14, by the way, I was an only child. I used to tell people my brother's an only child. That's a joke. I was an only child around 10, 11 years old, something like that. All of a sudden, I started to notice some strange behavior with my mom, or I became cognizant of it. Could have been happening before then, but I'm not sure. She would go to the door to lock it. She would twist the lock, and then she would look at it, and she would go, lock, 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 40 or 50 times over. She would go to turn the gas off on the stove, or the electric stove off, and she would turn it off, and she would go, off, off. And she'd go through that time after time after time. She went through the same thing with the door. Nobody knew anything about mental illness back then, right? I didn't know what was going on. I just thought, this is strange. It was the only thing that I knew. She had later in life after I'd gotten sober. She had true what they call obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, people tell me all the time, man, you're OCD, right? Because I like things just a particular way. But she had the true mental illness, obsessive compulsive disorder. And then around when I was, I'd say, 14, 15, something like that, she started to develop, she had always been very, very thin. And in fact, she used to use this term that said, she'd gotten from some queen that says you can never be too rich or too thin. And she used to quote that all the time. Well, she started to develop a combination of anorexia and bulimia. And it was bad. I mean, she would get down to like 80 pounds and such. And she would go out to the pool in the apartment complex where we would live, thinking she was looking all that, so to speak. It was embarrassing to me, and she didn't realize exactly what she looked like, and that's part of the illness when you have those particular illnesses. And so around 17 or so, so here you have me, who I'm, I guess, predisposed, I don't know, to alcoholism. I don't know if it's genetic or environmental or whatever the hell it is. But I'm her only son. I'm the only thing that represents sanity in her life. She's wanting to hold on to me for dear life. I am this budding alcoholic who has just now found alcohol, and I want to do nothing but be out of the house. You know, I love that my kids have bringing over their friends all the time now, or we're always, in fact, there's so many sleepovers, I get kind of tired of it, you know, but it's interesting, you know. I didn't have anybody tucking me into bed when I was a kid and saying, you can be anything you want. You're a good kid. You know, you're going to do great in anything you put your mind to. All those positive affirmations. In fact, sometimes I think, you know, I have got to start cutting my kids down a little bit because I got to give them something to overcome. I mean, I can't tell them they're that great, right? So she was developing, she had all this mental illness. Oh, and there was this other thing. She would get this weird asthma, like every day at the same time, and she would draw all the shades, she'd put the foil on the windows, and we would just be in there, and she would get, the doctors told her time after time, you don't have asthma, you know, something else was going on, and she was just having these health issues all the time, and she would see people out on the road, and they would say something, and it would greatly affect her to disturb her whole day. It was just chaotic in terms of emotional. Not only chaotic emotional, but she's trying to keep me at home. And we would get into these shoving matches. She would stand in front of the door and say, you're going nowhere. And she was not strong enough to stop me by that point. And I'd say, I'm leaving the house. And so we were having those sorts of physical, I mean, we didn't throw fists at each other or anything, but there was definitely a lot of pushing and shoving. And it was not the best scenario whatsoever. And so anyway, I basically ended up, another portion of this is we moved at least, she would always find people that we could live with. It seemed like we were always going to live with somebody here and live with somebody there, and we were constantly moving around, and nothing was stable whatsoever. And sometimes we'd live in two-bedroom apartments, sometimes we'd live in one-bedroom apartment, and I was sleeping on the couch, and it just went back and forth. And so anyway, I went out and kind of did my deal. I kind of moved on. By the time I was like 17 or so, I went and lived with some friends, and then lived in an apartment by myself, and I was kind of on my own. And then that's when the drinking and all the other associates that go with that started to pick up dramatically. So we split. I don't think I saw her for many years. I just couldn't bear it. So I'll take you to me getting sober. And I was sober when I was 27, 28, right in that area. I got sober and I went to my sponsor after I've been sober about a month or 2 months, something like that. And I went to him, I said, I want to make amends to my mom. He said, I'm not sure about that. Let's talk about that for a little while. We talked about it a little bit. And by this time, I knew that she had become what you call a bag lady. And the reason I knew is because my friends would see her. She'd be out walking the streets, and she had shaved her head and dyed it real black, the little bit of hair that she had left. She would wear all black. She would carry around these bags, and she would go into the stores all throughout this one particular area in North Dallas. Now, she had an apartment, but she walked throughout all these stores. And so I went down there to that area. Like I said, my buddies had seen her, and they had told me about her. And I went down there to find her, and lo and behold, she was there. I knew where she'd be walking, and my sponsor had said, whatever you do, just keep your side of the street clean. And I saw her from a distance, and I said, hey, Mom, keep in mind I'm an only son. And she turned around, and it's like she didn't recognize me to begin with. And then I said, hey, Mom, it's me. It's Johnny. And she looked at me with just some piercing eyes, and she said, "I hate you. Get out of my life. I never want to see you again." And she turned on her heels and she walked the other way. Now in my head, I knew it was her and her anger. But when you're a little kid, when you're a son, and that's your mom, and that's the reaction you get, it is very disheartening. So I went back to my sponsor. I told him what had happened. He said, "Listen, she is emotionally unavailable. Just let her be." And I did, and I got on with my life. I went back to school. I got my degree. By the way, I could never hardly even pass a class when I was in high school, and especially when I went to a couple of years of early college, it was one big party. But I ended up getting like a 3.76. I was on the dean's list several times, and that's not saying I'm brilliant. That just meant I was ready for it, and I studied, and I do what you're supposed to do. I did what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We come responsible, and we give back to the community and do what we're supposed to do. So that took about two and a half years. And I had these announcements for graduating in the back of my car. And nobody on my mom's side of the family had ever graduated from school. One person on my dad's side of the family had done it, but he was like a distant uncle. So I was one of the first ones ever to graduate from college. And so I'm driving down LBJ one day. And all of a sudden, I just got this thought, and it said, "It's time to go find her again." And I was like, "Oh, damn, I do not want to do this." But I just couldn't let it go. And so I pulled off the road. I went down to that same area. I walked in those shops where I know she roamed around. He said, "We know exactly who your mom is." I said, "But we haven't seen her in like a couple of weeks now," which is very unusual because she was in here every day. She got kicked out of many of the stores from, you know, just talking gibberish and doing all those sorts of things. So I started calling around to hospitals in the area. One of them I called was Parkland, and I got a hold of them down at Parkland. For those of you who don't know, Parkland is the city hospital down in Dallas. And so anyway, I got a hold of them, and they said, "We can't confirm or deny, but we'll take your number." And they took my number, and they called me back in a couple weeks, and they said, "We can confirm your mom is here. She's given us permission, and she has said that if you want to come visit her, you can come visit her." So I went down there to visit her, and what had happened is the judge had deemed her both a danger to herself and a danger to society. You know, we used to sit around the kitchen table, her talking about suicide all the time. And so I'm sure she had talked about suicide and things like that. I got down there to Parkland. It was on the upper floor, and I'll never forget walking in there. When I walked through those doors and the big clank is going, it was just like, you ever seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? It looked just like that, people wandering around aimlessly. My mom came and got me, and she was 78 pounds. And we sat down at a table, and there was a big window behind her. She talked about how she had talked about throwing herself out that window, and I'm, you know, obviously they have controls in place there. And I said, "I understand, Mom." And we talked for a little while. I told her what I was up to, and she says, "You know, you seem different. Isn't that God you speak about?" And I said, "I don't know, Mom." I said, "But I do know this. I want you to be happy and joyous and free, and I don't know how you're going to get there, but hopefully I can help you down that path in the future." And as I left there after about an hour or so of visiting with her, and that door closed behind me, and I heard that big steel door clank, and I was walking out to my car, I knew that because of that conversation that I personally would never be the same again. That a piece of me had floated away after that conversation, and I had made my amends the best that I could with her. Turns out while she was in there, they got her up before an audience. A bunch of students would observe her. They put hats and things on her, electrodes, and they were trying to figure out what was all going on in her brain. She was like a little, basically like a lab rat, you know. And that's part of the deal if you go and you get free treatment down somewhere like Parkland. But I just remember it kind of breaking my heart, you know, how did it get to this? And by that time, I had gotten on with my life. I was graduating from school. I was going to get a job. Things were going in the right direction for me. Fast forward about to the year 2000. We formed a relationship, and there's many twists and turns to this, but we formed a relationship. We started to get together. We got close to one another. She got on some medicine. She got well. We started to get along famously, really. And you know how those when you look at Mother's Day cards sometimes, how they all look like something that, or at least I used to look at them and I'd go, none of these work. Throughout that period of time, I would go to the store, Walgreens or whatever, and I would look at them, and all of those cards would work for her. Same mother, same son. Something had changed. She called me on October, the first part of October 2000. She was having stomach pains. She was not doing well, and I got her down to the emergency room. They checked her in. She was there a few days. I was out there visiting her every day, and then finally, the doctor called me on the, I called the doctor on the phone. I said, she's having some severe pain. She is tough. She's not trying to get more morphine. I promise you, she's not doing well. You need to get down here. I went back into her room to say hello. It was around noontime or so. And I stuck my hand out to say hello, or she stuck her hand out to grab mine. We were holding hands. All of a sudden, her little eyes rolled up in the back of her head. And I knew something dramatic was going on. I'm not a doctor, but I knew this was not good. And I went out there and I got the nurses, and the nurses hit that code blue thing. And there were like 15 medical personnel all of a sudden just swarmed in that room. And they were trying to revive her, but they couldn't do it. And my wife called. My wife said, hey, I think I have found somebody to help your mom. And I remember kneeling watching this. I said, she was my girlfriend at the time, Shannon. And I said, it's too late. I'm watching her die right in front of me. And so when we had the eulogy for her, or I gave the eulogy at the funeral, I remember thinking I had never felt grief like that in my entire life. I had felt a lot of things. I felt fear. I felt grief. I felt love. But one thing I did not feel or think about was regret. I said everything that I needed to say to her during those years when we were together, and I knew that she was in a better place. And then I went to clean out her apartment after it was all over with, and I looked up on the top shelf of her bedroom closet, and there was a shoebox and had all these letters and stuff in there, and I had every single one of those Mother's Day cards that I had written her during those years, and she had saved them. I wish she was here. She could see my family now. You guys know she never got to meet them. She even developed her own little relationship with God over those years. She'd say it like a little letter. She'd say, dear God. She used to call herself Twig, like Twiggy. She'd say, dear God, this is Twig. Just wanted to say, had a good day. Love, Twig. And that would be the God of her understanding, you know. There's so much more to talk about. I've had a good life, and it's all because of you people. I'll end it with this story. There's a group of people that are standing on a mountaintop, and they look out at the edge. They look down at the edge, and it's a long way down. They look down at the edge, and God says, come down to the edge. And they say, no, we can't. We may fall. And God looks down to them again, and he says, come down to the edge. And they say, no, we can't. We are afraid. And God looks down to him one more time, and he says, come down to the edge. And as they walk out to the edge, God pushes them, and they fly, and they never know fear again. And to me, that's what AA is all about. It's about coming to the edge, letting God push you, and getting over that fear. Thank you. Love you very much.